This is Brian Cambria with news for the KVNF listening area, Monday, April 29, 2013. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that dilution should protect the town of DeBec from benzene contamination in an upstream tributary of its water supply, the Colorado River. Town manager Guy Patterson said last week that no contamination has reached the town thus far. The river is the town's sole source of potable water, and DeBec is about 10 miles downstream from Parachute Creek, the site of benzene contamination from what Williams Petroleum says was a natural gas liquids leak from a pipeline leaving its gas processing plant. Groundwater and soil contamination involving thousands of gallons of hydrocarbons was discovered last month, but benzene hadn't been found in the creek until last week. However, the benzene levels in Parachute Creek remain below the state's safe drinking water standard of 5 parts per billion. The town of Parachute diverts its irrigation water supply 2.7 miles downstream of the leak source. No benzene has been detected there, nor at the creek's mouth at the Colorado River. Like others, DeBec was concerned about a lack of notification about the incident when it was first discovered. Officials first learned of it through media accounts, but Patterson said the town is now being kept up to date about surface water test results. Williams said Thursday it has completed installing a water aerator in the creek to remove benzene and other volatile organic compounds. Installation of similar systems making use of what are called air sparging devices are either pending or nearly complete in both the creek and underground along the creek bank, where a trench is also being built to try to keep benzene-tainted groundwater out of the creek. Williams has installed another well for recovery of liquid hydrocarbons, and two more are planned. It has continued to drill monitoring wells to delineate the extent of contaminated groundwater. The highest benzene measurement in the creek so far was 3.9 parts per billion on Tuesday. The high reading Thursday was 3.2, with additionally detections of 1.4 and 1.3 parts per billion at the next test locations downstream. The State Water Quality Control Division doesn't consider the creek a drinking water supply and has set a maximum benzene standard in the creek of 5,300 parts per billion to protect aquatic life. KVNF's Marty Derlin spoke with a Daily Sentinel reporter who has been covering the story.
After more than two decades as a journalist in Garfield and Mesa counties, Dennis Webb is a veteran when it comes to reporting about the oil and gas industry. But even he has admitted some difficulties when it comes to covering the Parachute incident.
It is complex. There's a kind of open the question of to what degree pipelines are regulated. And I started poking around, and the more I looked, the more it appears really some kind of a lack of regulation regarding a lot of pipelines early in the drilling process, what they call gathering lines that kind of link up, go from well to well, and get the gas to the first processing plants that seem to be rather unregulated across the country. And there's a federal agency that chooses not to regulate those just because of their tend to be lower pressure, lower volume, but they leave it to states if they want to do more, and Colorado doesn't, like most states, Colorado really doesn't do much more. So that kind of came to light, but then I need to emphasize that actually the pipeline in question that Williams is kind of fingered as the source, it's a different kind of line altogether that just technically runs from a plant on one side of the creek to some tanks on the other side where it's then piped up to another plant in Rio Blanco County on a federally regulated line. But the pipeline in question, really, it's so far all I've been able to find, all that anybody's told me for sure, is that OSHA regulates it. But OSHA says really all they do is regulate from kind of a worker safety standpoint. They're not really regulating the design of the line or you know, requirements to test it, those types of things. I think it's important to keep in mind, given that they're planning on putting a larger natural gas liquids line in that same corridor crossing under the creek.
What about the local, any kind of local like county or municipal control?
Yeah, and some counties have adopted some level of pipeline regulations, apparently kind of growing out of some of the concerns about some of this low level of regulation. Garfield County does have some pipeline regulations. They're kind of more focused just on land use. From what I could tell, they don't seem to get much into addressing like stream crossings. And they also, based on the dimensions of the pipeline and length of the pipeline, this line, again, doesn't fall under the county's that specific regulation because it's just too short of a pipeline.
Have you been out to that site? Is that how you've covered it, or have you mostly been on the phone talking to Todd Hartman of the state of Colorado and Williams officials and stuff like that?
You know, we tried to go out to the site pretty immediately after the news first broke. We were denied access to the media. To my knowledge, no media has ever actually been allowed on site, which I have to say is probably a little frustrating because certainly a number of public officials, county officials, for example, town of Parachute, have been out on site. And for whatever reason, so far, Williams, and technically it's WPX Energy, a natural gas oil and gas developer, owns the property. Williams has kind of rights over the pipeline corridor. They all were part of one company until they split up a year and a half ago. But so far, media has not been allowed on site, so you can kind of view it from the road. At least initially, I think there was a safety concern there, but again, they have been letting other folks up there. So, and quite honestly, I think it probably would be to Williams' benefit to let media there. I know some of the members of the public have been raising questions about why the media hasn't been allowed on site. Just to fully answer your question, so yeah, we do rely a lot on updates from Todd Hartman with State Department of Natural Resources. He's a spokesman representing that agency, oversees the COGCC, and then Williams, and talking to local county officials and trying to piece together things, talking to various regulatory agencies. And activists, citizen activists. There's been one guy, Bob Arrington, a retired engineer in nearby Battle Mesa, who's really been asking a lot of good questions and raising things kind of in advance that turn out to be true. He basically said that pressure valve was the likely source. The first time he heard it leaked at all, he said, oh, that would explain it all. And he later predicted it pretty much where he thought it would enter, the benzene would enter Parachute Creek, and he turned out to be right on that as well.
That was Daily Sentinel reporter Dennis Webb. For KVNF News, I'm Marty Derlin.
Authorities said Saturday the responsibility of overseeing the investigation and cleanup of the natural gas liquids near Parachute will shift from state oil and gas regulators to health officials. According to Todd Hartman, spokesman for the State Department of Natural Resources, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission and the State Department of Public Health and Environment have agreed that the Health Department will assume primary jurisdiction. Meanwhile, Garfield County will hold a 6 p.m. community meeting today about the leak. Representatives from four agencies will answer questions. The event will be at the Grand Valley Fire Protection District building at 124 Stone Quarry Road in Battlement Mesa. Those unable to attend may call Kirby Wynn at 970-625-5905. NPR's Morning Edition reported earlier today that consumer spending is up around the country, but they may not have been looking at the Western Slope. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that the latest sales tax collection data reported by Mesa County and Grand Valley municipalities shows slides in the amount of revenue they are collecting via sales taxes as compared with the same time last year. The drop is especially significant for both Mesa County and the city of Grand Junction. Through the first 3 months of the year, the county is off 4.61% year-to-date in sales tax revenue, and Grand Junction is collecting 5.1% less in sales and use taxes than it did through the first 3 months of 2012. That has officials rethinking the budgets they had planned for 2013. Mesa County Finance Director Marcia Arnold said said, "We're going back to look at our capital plan, and we may have to make some adjustments because we're not going to have the revenues that we anticipated," end quote. For Mesa County, the recent negative trend began last July, when collections for that month were close to 1% less than July of 2011. That snapped a streak of 7 straight months of revenue growth as compared to the previous year. Between July of 2012 and March of 2013, all but one of the months showed negative growth in terms of monthly sales tax collections as compared to the previous year. Grand Junction Financial Operations Director Jody Romero told the Daily Sentinel the city has been able to absorb the revenue loss so far with savings from other budget segments, but officials are monitoring the situation very closely. Both Fruta and Palisade are also tallying less in sales tax collections. More details are available on what happened during the April 20th deadly avalanche on Loveland Pass. The Colorado Avalanche Information Center released their final report on Wednesday, April 24th. It was the worst accident of its kind in more than a half century. There are some painful details in the report, like the lone survivor waiting 4 hours to be dug out and the slide being powerful enough to wreck a car. Aspen Public Radio's Elise Thatcher spoke with Colorado Avalanche Information Center Executive Director Ethan Green.
In the report, the CAIC nails down some scientific specifics, like the exact size and classification of the slide.
Because we actually got out there with measuring tapes rather than just using people's estimates.
But what really made the difference was being able to talk with the only person who escaped dying. That was Crested Butte snowboarder Jerome Boulay.
Fortunately, he was very helpful and really spent a lot of time with us, kind of walking through what the group was doing and then what happened during and after the avalanche.
And what did he tell you that you didn't know before?
A lot of times in these reports, we can kind of make some educated guesses about things that happened, but we tend to be pretty careful about speculating because, you know, we're dealing with some very sensitive subjects. And so in this case, you know, really being able to talk to him and have him explain to us what happened, it took away a lot of the speculation and it allowed us to really describe the details with a lot more confidence than we would in some other accidents.
Why is it important having those details? What kind of difference does it make?
Well, I think it really helps other people learn from this experience. There's kind of two main reasons that we do these reports. One is to document, human involvement with this particular natural hazard so that we can do research on both the types of avalanches that people get involved in and how they get involved in them and provide, those data to other people. The CAIC keeps the national record of avalanche accidents, and the data set goes back to about 1900. The other reason is, more kind of salient. It really impacts people right away rather than kind of over time, which is really to explain to the best of our ability what happened to people that people know, to around accidents that happened this year, and really hope that people can learn from them. You know, there's going to be people out in the same sort of snowpack that these folks were in, and hopefully they'll be able to look at this report and apply some of the information. You know, for all of us, we really want to use this event. It's a tragic event, but really, the only thing that could make it any worse would be for us not to learn from what happened.
You know, I have talked with at least one person after this particular accident who said, A, you can never be too prepared in the backcountry. Do everything you can. But at the same time, you run the risk of dying out there. This particular avalanche was so massive that, and the conditions were so tricky that the outcome perhaps in some ways was unavoidable. And I wonder what you think about that. Sometimes folks seem to imply that these things just happen.
You know, I guess you could say that really about any of the events of our lives, that things do happen. And sometimes, very unfortunate things happen. And sometimes they happen to very good people. You know, from looking at this avalanche, our conclusion was that it was avoidable. And the reasons are that the group read the avalanche advisory and talked about the problem, but then the steps that they took to address the problem really weren't adequate for this type of avalanche. And the reason potentially for that, and we don't really know, is that this type of avalanche, like the person you talked to said, was really large. It's larger than the avalanches that most people come in contact with and that most people prepare for when they're taking, you know, some precautions to mitigate the risk from avalanches. And these gentlemen did take steps to mitigate the risk based on their discussion and what they had talked about. But in this particular case, they just weren't big enough. You know, certainly bad things happen. There's no way to get around that. But I don't know if it really helps us to throw everything bad that happens into that category.
That was Aspen Public Radio's Elise Thatcher with Avalanche Information Center Director Ethan Green last week. On IC Change at thealmanac.org last week, it was all about crazy weather. From sunny days to pelting hail, or as Andrea Lakos put it, rain, snow, wind, repeat. But the additional moisture has brought the Gunnison River snowpack up to 89% of normal. As of April 24th, the Colorado Snowtell Report indicates the San Miguel, Animas, Dolores, and San Juan basins at 66% of normal. The main Colorado stem is showing 109% of normal for April, and the statewide measurement is 92%. It's important to stress this information is reported as provisional, meaning it's subject to change and may not provide a valid measure of conditions. The next official report should come out after the first week of May, and all agencies are reporting that we are still in a drought and can anticipate low water for this coming summer season. What change have you seen? Is your garden progressing normally? How are your fruit trees, your lawn? Do you have irrigation water yet? How does it compare so far this year? You can be a part of the IC Change record by visiting thealmanac.org. Do it. Be a part of Two-Way Radio. Thus concludes today's newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria. Good day.